The Daily
with Dave Hodgson on Talk Radio Europe.
Welcome back to the show. So it was a couple of weeks ago, I was sitting at home on the chaise lounge and I was watching Russia Today, and I came across a clip of Tony Gosling from Bilderberg.org. And so I was delighted when Tony agreed initially to come on the Tonight programme a few weeks ago when I was sitting in for Lisa. And Tony's back with us today. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Dave.
How are you? All right?
Very well, and actually, I hate to disappoint you, but it's actually quite sunny here in Somerset at the moment.
Is it really? Okay.
Yeah. We had a forecast for a whole day of rain, but the rain decided to go up to Wales instead.
Oh, that's well, it always goes to Wales, doesn't it, anyway? But, Tony, it's great to have you on again, it becoming a bit of a friend of the show. It's great to have you here. Now, let's start off today with the news that's been breaking all across the UK, and that's the Murdoch situation. It's back at Westminster today, isn't it? Live on Sky and BBC News and so on. What's your take on it, then?
Well, I've just been listening to the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee interviewing James, and I mean, really, he is becoming less and less credible almost every word he speaks. And I think the idea that we're supposed to buy this whole business that I mean, what they seem to be doing, in fact, very wisely, the Culture, Media and Sport people, is slowly building a case against him. Every time he appears in public now, there are more people from his former employees of his who are testifying in public against him, to saying essentially that he's been lying to the public bodies that he's been reporting back to. And in that sort of situation, at some point, you would think that he would back down. But I'm afraid that odds are so massively stacked. I mean, he's put so much effort into keeping his credibility up. We've also got a big connection, of course, with Andy Coulson and David Cameron and Downing Street with all of this. So if James Murdoch goes down, then also, to a certain extent, Cameron will be hit as well. So there's a lot at stake here, and so I'm not entirely surprised to see James Murdoch toughing it out, basically saying that the other employees of his, former employees of his, have been misleading the public, lying essentially to the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee, because that's the point that they're very, very precise about putting that point to him. Are you saying that Parliament has been misled by your former employees? And he's saying eventually at the end of, after a little bit of pressing, he said, yes, I am.
He's trying to tough it out. Yeah, now, the crux of the matter, Tony, is it really down to the fact that did he know about it? Was it right across the company, or was it something that was going on unaware? And at the very least, even if he doesn't know about it, then that's bad management, isn't it?
I don't think there's really very many people out there that believes that James Murdoch didn't know about this. I mean, you know, there are checks to be signed, and this is a program that was going on over many years and had all sorts of different facets to it. It's also become quite clear now through the publishing of emails that certainly maybe he didn't bother to read emails that went to him, but it's quite clear that he was in the loop with this phone hacking. But the thing that bothers me most about it is it shows a kind of gangster culture at the heart of the Murdoch empire, which extended through Andy Coulson, the mastermind of all this, right into the heart of Downing Street. This is a problem because, I mean, the thing was with the information that was being collected by Glenn Mulcair and other people, private detectives, etc., for the Murdoch empire, was it didn't always appear in the newspaper. This information was actually, it seems, used to intimidate people. And this is where we start to go into the realms of, this is not just a newspaper reporting stuff. This is a kind of intimidatory tactic by the Murdoch empire. Now, I mean, I was very friendly with a chap here in Bristol before he died, sadly, a couple of years ago, Louis Sherwood, who was the chairman of HTV television for many years, right, through the 70s and 80s. And I remember mentioning Murdoch to Louis, and he looked at me, "Don't mention that man's name around me. He's poison." And many people in the media were very much aware, maybe they didn't say this in public, but they were very much aware that the whole Murdoch operation was absolutely ruthless. I mean, it started with a very, very strong union-breaking policy back in the 1980s when we had all the stuff with the move to Wapping when Murdoch took over the Times. And it's I think, been right from that moment, it's been a very ruthless and actually quite a political operation, because, as you know, the press, to a large extent, especially with with TV as well, and Sky TV, has the chance to. It's really important we have people of integrity running it, because they can set the political agenda.
This is the problem, isn't it?
What is talked about and what isn't talked about.
This is the problem, isn't it? That I mean, I've seen the documentary Outfoxed, and you know, talk about, there is definitely, whether you on their side or not, there is a bias, and I'm sure most TV channels have some degree of bias. But you know, it just, how intrinsically linked is the government to Murdoch?
Well, quite clearly, the Conservative Party is clearly linked to it, and actually also through organisations which are basically pro-Zionist. So we're talking about the Zionist lobby. This is something which isn't often talked about. Peter Oborne did quite a good documentary 3 or 4 months ago on Channel 4 about the Zionist lobby. That is to say, the pro-Israeli state lobby, which is extremely powerful amongst all the main political parties, the Labour, Liberal and Conservative parties, a lot of their influence in those parties comes from the Zionist lobby, which is a very wealthy lobby. And this takes place behind the scenes. Now, the other thing is that in parallel with that, you've got Murdoch as essentially a pro-Zionist newspaper empire as well. So they tend to put the pro-Israeli point of view. I mean, we're in a situation now with a standoff in the Middle East, where in the Guardian last week we heard that British forces are preparing a possible attack on Iran. They're actually now in the preparatory stages, just in case they need to do it. Now, what are we doing? Because this is potentially a fuse here burning for a very open Third World War, you know, with not just Saddam's invisible weapons of mass destruction. We're talking about the real weapons of mass destruction, potentially.
Yeah.
So the problem being that there is really a lack of reality about the Middle Eastern situation, which is that Israel is and has been equipped with nuclear weapons for about the last 20 years or so, and seems to also be extremely a belligerent state, you know, being actually quite threatening towards other states. And now when you have, in parallel with that, Condoleezza Rice in the United States saying we will use any means whatever to take down the Iranian regime, then we've got a serious problem. We're in a sort of almost a pre-World War II type situation, where threats are being made to simply run roughshod over the rule of law around the world and just simply take out regimes, a bit like Hitler was doing it by annexing Austria, annexing Czechoslovakia, and then eventually, of course, the Sudetenland, and then eventually, of course, going into Poland. This is crazy talk. We shouldn't even be talking about regime change at all, because that is the fuel for a possible world war.
I suppose, if Israel were to attack Iran or Britain, America would be quite, you know, they may not be saying yes, go and do it, but there will certainly be no opposition from America on that, in that, would there? If Israel were to strike.
Not at the moment. You see, the thing is, of course, that doesn't mean to say that the American people wouldn't oppose it.
Yeah.
Of course they would. Most ordinary American people would. And doesn't that kind of show us that America is not a democracy, and that possibly if we are in a similar situation here in Britain, making similar noises, that we are not democratic? I think there is a real democratic deficit, I mean, that's what I would call it, between the views of ordinary people on the street and what our governments are representing in international forums. Like, for example, we've had also just yesterday a statement in the House of Commons by William Hague about Palestine, where he's saying that it is the considered view of the Foreign Office that the best route to help peace in the Middle East and to help the two-state solution is to actually abstain when there's a vote comes to the Security Council about the Palestinian state becoming part of the United Nations. Now, surely, if they believe in a two-state solution, which Hague says he does, you know, you should be supporting the admission of the state of Palestine in order to make a level playing field, at which point negotiations can continue. And at the moment, we've got a very unequal playing field with Israel holding all the cards.
There's a lot of politics there, isn't there, Tony? In that, you know, it's not just this is what we said we're going to do, and this is what we're going to do, but they're checking it by the day, aren't they?
Yes, Dave. And what I'm saying is, again, the democratic deficit. I mean, if you were to talk to people, as we do on our show in Bristol, we do on the radio, to people in the street and ask them, generally speaking, you know, you get a fairly common sense point of view, which is, yes, of course, if they're going to be a separate state, the Palestinians should have some representation at the United Nations. That's the common sense view. And yet that common sense view is not being represented in these international fora, I'm afraid. And I'll tell you where you will hear that common sense point of view, and that is at one of the 12 or so camps around Britain which have sprung up over the last few weeks. You know, one obviously the most famous is the one outside St Paul's Cathedral, but Birmingham has got one. We have in Bristol, in various other cities, up in Scotland as well. These camps are appearing with people sort of camping out because it seems that the decision-making process at the top is failing us to such an extent, and everyone can see it's kind of coming to their door, the possibility that they may lose their jobs, they may lose their basic amount of money that they need, the Social Security, in order to feed their families. People are worried about this.
Yeah.
So it seems there's a genuine upswell of opinion that says, look, if the system isn't working, and if we're not having our views represented by central government, then we shall start a whole political process from the grassroots up, from the bottom up, and that's
I'm quite encouraged by that, you know, that people are actually, you know, because we've had so long now where people are just allowing things to happen to them, and I'm quite encouraged that people are taking the stance now, aren't they?
Well, it's not just Occupy Wall Street. Look at the extent of this, Dave. It's incredible. We've got 450 cities now across the world where these other, you know, as far as I know, none in China, because the Chinese authorities would take this sort of thing rather seriously and finish it as soon as possible. Yeah, but in all the continents of the world now, we've got 450 cities where these camps have appeared. So it's not just Britain this is happening. I don't know if you saw, but there was a statement, I think it was made by one of the British journalists in the mainstream press, saying every continent apart from Antarctica has got one of these grassroots political camps. I mean, it's quite an amazing phenomenon to see, really. Anyway,
Tony,
and then within a few hours, there was a bunch of people at a remote research station in Antarctica that had got a photograph up of them protesting too outside their camp. So even including Antarctica, they have their own protest camp as well.
Now, Tony, we're going to go to a commercial break. I've got two questions to ask you outside after the break. One about the Euro bailout in Italy, and secondly, where can we find good media from? So stay listening, and Tony will be back in just a jiffy.
From Marbella to Gibraltar on 91.9, this is Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain.
The Daily
with Dave Hodgson.
Welcome back to The Daily with me, Dave Hodgson, here on Talk Radio Europe. You can join the conversation as well, 951-036-026, 951-036-026, or you can email studio at talkradioeurope.com. You can also call us on 902-444-461, 902-444-461, and why don't you join in the conversation if you have a view to or an opinion to give. Now, we're going to go back to Tony. Today, happening in the news today, new president in Greece, Italy still in turmoil. Tony, what's your viewpoint on the Euro bailout at the moment?
Well, I'm quite disappointed to see that Mr. Papandreou wasn't able to, for whatever reason, in Greece, actually go to the people. I mean, surely the people of Greece, it's about time they had a say in all of this.
Yeah.
One of the comments, I think, is from Paul Mason on the BBC Newsnight guy. I mean, I'd much prefer him to the Robert Peston, who I don't really rate highly, but Paul's saying that we've got a situation, he's quite right about this, where the bond markets are now choosing our politicians for us, and that there's always a bit of a tension, really, between the markets and the people, isn't there, in politics, where the markets want the country to go in a certain direction, allegedly, and the people want to go maybe in another direction. The bond markets generally want there to be very strict financial measures, which mean that not a lot of money goes to people who aren't maybe physically fit. I mean, for example, money that goes to people of physical disabilities doesn't really feature in the bond market's worldview, whereas ordinary people do think it's quite important to look after those who are disadvantaged and the elderly and people like that. So, you know, the bond markets and the ordinary politics, there's a big tension between them. And we had a stage, didn't we, last week, where it was possible that Papandreou in Greece was going to be able to go to the people and ask them to make a decision about this. In a way, it's like calling a snap general election, which is someone, you know, people have done in history in reasonably recent. I think the last one was about Harold Wilson yes, I think it was Wilson that called the last snap election in Britain, which is basically to say to the city and to the financiers, look, who is running this country? Let's let the people decide whether you, the financial people, want to run things and we don't, or we, the politicians. And certainly Papandreou attempted to do that last week and failed. What's happened is the bond markets have kicked in. It's kind of like having a gun pointed to the head of the politicians in Greece saying, look, you're going to have to do this or else. And I think, in a way, it's from what I was saying before the break, is that the scales are falling from our eyes a little bit, aren't they? And we're seeing, well, actually, politics is not really about us crossing a ballot box at election time. It seems that it's actually driven by the financial elite around the world. And these financial elite are not accessible people. I mean, they are super rich. They almost function like a cult. You know, they're very, very close-knit, and they are not, you know, they live a completely different world. It's almost, you know, we have the British class system with the upper class, the middle class, the lower class, and working class in Britain. Everybody knows that. But this is like a super elite, above all that, almost, who have very, very little to do with ordinary life. But they do, it seems, and looking at the what's been going on in Italy and Greece in the last week or so, they really do, it seems, call the shots. Now,
Tony,
one of the things...
Tony, we're not going to ever have a true democracy whilst we have our political parties so intrinsically linked to major corporations who are funding them for election campaigns and so on, which happens in America as well in the UK. They're linked so much, aren't they?
That's true, but at least we had a chance of a little snip of democracy last week when Papandreou, I think, pulled a blinder, you know, really, saying, okay, we're going to ask the people about this. And yet what happened was it wasn't allowed. Now, the threat that was used against Greece, it's fascinating this, the threat that was used was that, oh, okay, we won't let you have any of this European Financial Security Fund money if you go to the people. You know, basically your government is going to run out of money before you have a chance to have your referendum. And so they changed their mind. Okay, we won't have a referendum. We'll just change the Prime Minister and put one of your people in charge. But unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that this EFSF, they call it, European Financial Security Fund, is dead in the water because they were relying on the Chinese to invest in it, and the Chinese have taken one look at it and decided, no, we're not interested. Well, so the whole thing is a bluff.
Tony,
how can you be playing with these kind of bluffs with the lives of millions of people at stake?
Well, I was listening yesterday, and they were saying that Italy needs $300 billion to keep them going for another year, and there's $250 in the relief fund as far as the European Union goes. Something's not matching up here, is it?
Well, it's a transfer of power from Berlusconi to the what they're calling the technocratic elite. And I would be really rather worried about a technocratic elite running things. They're supposed to be experts, yeah?
Yeah.
Now, what have the experts delivered so far in terms of financial security? They've delivered us into the hands of the vultures. You know, this is what we're doing now, is that the vultures are taking the pickings of these various important, you know, parts of our infrastructure and now being privatized into their hands. I think it's very dangerous and actually quite fascistic. I mean, you know, the idea that these so-called experts are the best people to make decisions for us, I'm not at all convinced by that. I'd much rather see ordinary local politicians and these kinds of people making these decisions rather than experts. Because you have a look at websites such as Spinwatch, you will find that almost every single one of these experts is getting a bung from somebody along the line, you know, that they are actually being funded by one corporation or another corporation, that they're not independent at all.
Yeah. Now, Tony, we're going to change tact a little bit here and just talk about, we touched on this at the beginning, we're talking about Murdoch, and you want to just say about, there are those out there who are talking a lot of sense, and there's a lot of media channels that are worth a listen to, aren't there? I mean, people like Russia Today, I find quite informative. Is there any out there that you can say, yes, these seem to be doing a good job?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's the way we get our news nowadays has changed quite a lot, especially if you talk to young people. You find most of them get their news on their phone or one way or another on the internet, and they pick and choose where they get their news sources from, what they trust.
Yeah.
Because I'm afraid the old methods, I mean, this is a pity, but of course a lot of older people still trust those news outlets which used to be trustworthy, which now we're finding are actually behind the curve. So I would say, as regards, let's start maybe with newspapers. Quite clearly, Rupert Murdoch's papers I would avoid like the plague, that is to say The Sun and The Times. But one thing that has been quite successful is The Independent, the most recent version of The Independent. Of course, one of the best Middle East commentators out there is Robert Fisk. The BBC won't have him on because I remember hearing him talking about this on Irish radio, funnily enough.
Yeah.
Robert Fisk said that whenever he's invited onto the BBC, they always have a long conversation with him beforehand, asking him, what are you going to say, Robert, if we ask you this, if we ask you this, if we ask you this? And his reply, quite rightly, is, I'm not going to tell you.
Yeah.
And so they say, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Fisk, we can't have you on then. So, you know, this is Robert's stuff in the Independent has been really a brilliant bit of commentary. He also used to work for The Times, had his copy altered by Rupert Murdoch's editor of The Times, and refused to work for them ever again at that point.
Yeah.
And it's nice that, you know, there was another paper that he could jump to and work for The Independent, whereas not all journalists are in that position where they can, you know, walk into another job, but with Fisk's reputation. So that's a really good source. And the great thing about the Independent paper is that here in Britain we have the I edition. I'm not sure if you have that out there, do you?
No, we can get a lot of papers out here. I'm not sure about the Eye itself, but yeah.
The Eye is very cheap. It's 20 pence a go, and it's actually a really good news digest. I find, I'm in the Journalists' Union, and I find many other journalists are also buying the Eye, you know, basically
yeah.
They want to sit down and have a cup of coffee rather than read their news on the internet. But it's actually a pretty good source of news. It's a good digest. They have a good business section, which has summaries of all the main business stories of the day, and, you know, it's concise copy, which isn't too politically slanted one way or the other. It's got a few different points of view, and they've got some good columnists who are coming from very different political viewpoints. So it's a kind of journalist paper, The Independent, at the moment.
Okay, so that's worth a look at then, definitely. Now,
yeah.
Tony...
The Guardian is always good, because
yeah.
They tend to do some of the really important civil liberties, break those stories and work on them, you know, and that's the great tradition of The Guardian, which originally was set up after the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester in the 1800s. As a voice of the people kind of paper, which was run as a trust, not for profit. And, you know, The Guardian's kept in that tradition, and it's been leading the way with the phone hacking story, even though, you know, the story may have come out sort of 8 years ago. The Guardian editors had had the legal advice saying, yes, you can print this story.
Yeah.
So The Guardian's a good one. I think on the internet, I think it depends what you want. You know, I think for sort of rolling bits and pieces of international news day to day, whatreallyhappened.com is
All right.
a really good source of information. It's run by a guy called Mike Rivero. He was a former Hollywood film maker, and he decided to chuck it in because he couldn't make any decent films in Hollywood. He couldn't raise the money to make the
yeah.
films he wanted to make. So decided to do a daily English language news digest on the internet.
So whatreallyhappened.com?
Whatreallyhappened.com has a really good, like, spread of loads of stuff from all over the world. But I don't agree with Mike's totally on his editorial policy,
yeah.
but you will definitely find something in there to pique your interest. And always, every single day, there's something where you scratch your head and you think, well, why isn't that on the news today?
Now, Tony, before we go, we can carry on all day, me and you talking. I just want to ask you a quick question. You're a very passionate person. How do you rest from all of what's going on in the world? How do you take this time aside? Are you somebody that can rest, or are you just always passionate like this?
Well, yeah, I think it's absolutely crucial in a high-pressure job like journalism, especially when you're doing a programme which we are in Bristol, which is really dealing with national stories
yeah.
from a provincial point of view. Is it really important to take a step back? you know, every once in a while, you know, evenings off, days off. And I actually, for me, I recharge my batteries out in the countryside. I've got some friends who got a kind of eco-village that they built in Somerset. Fantastic. And that's one of the places I quite often go, just to sit around the fire, relax, recharge my batteries, have a good chat.
It's good to know that, Tony, because I don't want you to have a heart attack around it, because you're very passionate and there's so much news happening all the time. We want you back on here.
Okay, also, I mean, for me, it's a question of not feeling like it's all my responsibility.
Yeah.
I'm actually, I am a person of faith, and I actually think that God will deal with a lot of these things. I don't get too concerned about it myself, but I do think it's important, and all journalists, I think, should do this, and very few are actually able to, which is to follow the story to its own end, and not to be afraid if that story goes in a difficult direction, not to sort of skirt around it, so you're not upsetting the apple cart.
Tony,
as far as I'm concerned, you can just follow the story wherever it goes.
Tony, we're going to have to go, because I've got to go to the sports desk in a moment, but you know, maybe we'll get you on the two red. If you're talking about your faith, maybe we'll get you on our religious program on a Sunday morning. But Tony Gosling, thank you very much from Bordeaux.
Hang on, Dave. Yeah. I have Sundays off, so I can't be
off. Okay, all right.
I have a bit of time off sometime.
Yeah, you got to. Yeah, Bilderberg.org.
Thanks ever so much for having me on again,
buddy. Tony, speak to you soon. Take care. God bless.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye. That's Tony Gosling there from Bilderberg.org.